Well, let's see. It's February 11th, so we've safely moved past the holidays, kind of settled into the rhythm of the new year. So I think it's safe then for me to bring up the holidays without too much post-traumatic stress, right? I want to think a little bit about what happens at a major family meal, a big gathering, a holiday meal. For me, I grew up, my family hosting Thanksgiving, so we'd have lots of people coming over for Thanksgiving meal. And there was all this planning and preparation and getting the house clean and all this stuff to do to get it ready. But often, the meal didn't quite go as planned. I found a website where somebody was soliciting a group of people to contribute four words that were sure to ruin Thanksgiving dinner. Many of them weren't Sunday morning appropriate, but some of them were. Some of them were, my mother is coming. There is no pie. You are bringing him. I invited my ex. Or I invited your ex. Forgot my stretchy pants. Making my own tofurkey. And of course, the comment sure to bring debate. Let's talk about Trump. These big special occasions we have, people are gathered around, and yet often they don't quite end up going the way we think. Well, as Mo mentioned, we're starting this new series this morning for the season of Lent. We're looking through the last 18 hours of Jesus' life from the Gospel of Matthew. And we're trying to focus on this period because as the book of Matthew unfolds, this time period is like this intense, dramatic period where every little thing that happens seems to matter. We're calling the series The Final Hours to try to capture some of the drama that Matthew tries to express through these events. And as you're reading the book of Matthew, what happens when you get here is the whole pace of the book slows down. The first couple chapters of Matthew deal with Jesus' birth. Then you have about 17 chapters that deal with Jesus' 3 years of ministry, itinerant ministry walking throughout the area. And then during that final week, he enters into Jerusalem. There's about 5 chapters of the first several days of that period. And then these last 18 hours cover almost 2 full chapters because everything is important. It's the slow motion portion of the movie. And it's a big deal because everything is building up to something that we know is about to happen. All the events leading up to this point have been leading forward. All the preparations have been in place to get to this moment. We can sense it. Something big is coming. We just don't know what. What will happen? What will Jesus do? What will be the result? With dinner, this big special dinner, things don't always go as planned. And we're going to see that this 18 hours kicks off with a very special dinner with some very unexpected surprises. So this morning as we kick off the series, we'll be thinking about unexpected twists at the table. What happens when your plans don't exactly work out? What happens when life doesn't work out the way you think it might? What happens when following Jesus looks a lot different than you intended? What happens when your carefully planned life is ruined in an instant? Lent is a season of questioning, of reflection. It's a somber season to slow down and ask those hard questions that we otherwise might avoid. For thousands of years, followers of Jesus have taken these 40 days as a slow march toward the worst thing that ever happened in history. Lent is like watching a train wreck in slow motion. But we can do that because we know that the worst thing becomes the best thing. Death gives way to life. Failure gives way to victory. And so we enter into this season knowing that it's a painful one, knowing that it's a difficult one because we know something else is to come. And we celebrate the resurrection and the life that Jesus offers throughout most of the other times of the year. But for now, we enter into the pain because in doing so, it helps us to understand the pain in our own lives. It helps us to understand the pain of the world around us. It helps us to understand the pain of each other. This morning, the story of those 18 hours begin with the meal. So let's look at the events leading up to this meal and the meal itself and see how those surprises carry the story. I think the disciples were looking forward to the familiar traditions of the Passover. It had been a crazy week. They'd entered into Jerusalem with shouts of Hosanna. Jesus had overturned the tables in the temple. He'd been healing people. He'd been giving sermons. He'd been in almost constant conflict with the religious leaders of his day. I think the disciples were just anxious to sit down to a meal where they knew how things would go. Little did they know, it would not go the way they intended. Here's how it begins. Matthew 26, I'll read from verses 17 through 19. Now on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us prepare to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. The disciples assumed that they were going to eat the Passover with Jesus. And right away, this is a bit of an interesting assumption. Passover was a family meal. There were special roles for fathers to play and children to play. And yet here the disciples were, many of whom were probably married, many of whom probably had their own children, intending not to eat Passover with their families, but with the other disciples and Jesus. I think what they realized was that this new band, this ragged band of individuals following this revolutionary figure, they were a new family. Their allegiance to this new group was higher and deeper than anything else in their lives. And so they asked Jesus, "Where shall we, as a new family, have Passover together?" And he gives them these cryptic instructions, "Go into the city and talk to a certain man, and we're going to eat at his house." I want us to think a minute about that certain man. Who was he? We don't know anything about him. We don't know his name. We don't know what was going on in his life up to this point. And what was his backstory? Had God showed up to him in a vision? Had God told him that you are meant to host this group that's going to come? Or was he just really flexible and he, you know, welcomed 13 extra people in his house at a moment's notice on the biggest day of the year? Maybe. I think he had a story. There's no way of knowing, but I think God was at work in his life. I think he was prepared. I think he knew that tonight something big was going to happen. And I like to think about all the things that might have happened for him leading up to that moment when a bunch of men found him on the street and said, "The teacher says my time has come." In my house, lately we've been in the pattern of hosting Thanksgiving, and we like to do things kind of the same way every year. So I've come up with a schedule of things that have to happen beginning on Tuesday so that on Thursday at the right time, everything's ready together. You know, things like setting out the bread to dry for the stuffing, and you make the cranberry sauce so it can chill, and you put the turkey in the baste and all the stuff, and you kind of, and everything has an hour. And if you follow the schedule right, when you get to Thursday at dinner time, everything emerges and it's perfect. And we sit down to a glorious meal, and no one says troublesome four words, right? Now think about God's planning, not just for 2 days leading up to one big meal, but throughout history, leading up to this moment when the teacher says, "My time is at hand." Think about all the things that had to happen. The creation itself, the fall and the entrance of sin, the years that God's people spent as slaves in Egypt, that first Passover night when God would free his people and give them a meal that would be celebrated for thousands of years to come, the chaos of years with the judges, the cycle of good kings and bad kings and evil kings, the exile, the return from exile back to the land, and then the waiting and the wishing and the hoping that the foreign powers would leave and God would finally restore his kingdom to a Jewish king. Think about the disciples and their growing up and then meeting Jesus on the street and giving up everything to follow him and all the years they'd walked with him and now coming into Jerusalem and the buildup of now it's Passover night and something's going to happen. All of those things laid out in a schedule to arrive at this night. And everyone asking the question, what's going to happen next? What's next? This is how God works. He's been working in the world throughout history. He's been working in the life of our church for the last 70 years. He's been working in each and every one of your lives, leading you up to whatever it is he's planning for you. What will God do next for us? We can begin this morning by anticipating what it is that God is preparing us for. Anticipate what God will do. This is one of the great privileges of following Jesus. We're not alone at the wheel. Our life is not a series of accidents and surprises that are just randomly strung together. There is someone, there is a creator, there is a sustainer who is orchestrating things, who is taking care of things that we can relax into. What has led you here today? Think about growing up. Think about school. Think about your relationships. Maybe you're married. Maybe you have children. Maybe you have a job. Maybe you've gone through several jobs. What are all the things that have happened in your life? The joys, the amazing things, the painful things that you never thought you'd have to face. What are all those things that have happened to get you here now? And what might God be doing next? See, we live in a culture where we are told that we have to figure out the answer to that question. We have to know what comes next. We have to have a strategic plan. You got to know where you're going to be in 1 year and 3 years and 5 years. You have to have it all figured out or else how's it going to work? But we know, if you know Jesus, that you don't have to have it all figured out. You just have to know the one who does have it figured out. And so you can look at yourself and you can look at what God's been doing and you can ask the question, what is God up to? What will he do in my life? Where is he leading me? And we can settle back and rest into that knowledge that God has a plan for us. Take some time. Reflect. What will God do next? The disciples had a keen sense of anticipation for this night. They thought they knew what was coming next. It was Passover. They knew how this would work. But they sit down to this familiar meal, and Jesus drops a bomb. Listen to verses 20 through 25. When it was evening, he reclined at table with the 12, and as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were very sorrowful and began to say to him one after another, "Is it I, Lord?" He answered, "He who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born." Judas, who would betray him, answered, "Is it I, Rabbi?" He said to him, "You have said so." Think back to those four words that could ruin Thanksgiving. Well, Jesus says six words, five in the Greek, that were sure to ruin Passover. "One of you will betray me." We'd already recognized that this group thought of themselves as a new family. They were loyal to each other over and above all the other relationships in their lives. This was their unit. They thought they were together. They thought they were in this for the long haul. And Jesus tells them, one of you among us is a spy. One of you will turn me in. We're not as unified as you think. Can you imagine how that must have felt? The Passover celebration had a traditional question that initiated the evening, that the children were supposed to ask, what makes this night different from any other night? And the head of the household was supposed to reply with the story of how this night commemorated the freedom from slavery from Egypt. And so this night was looking back to that story in the Jews' history. But at this Passover meal, a different question was being asked. Instead of asking a question that looks back to God's faithfulness, each disciple in turn asks a question that wonders about their own unfaithfulness. I think it's remarkable that they would ask that. I would expect if Jesus said, one of you will betray me, they would say, who? Or, never in a million years, Jesus. Or, come on, not us. But each of them seems to wonder if it's them. Is it I, Lord? Makes me think that every single one of them had considered the possibility of betraying Jesus. Maybe they decided against it, most of them anyway, but they'd thought about it. And so when Jesus said, one of you will do this, each of them is wondering, am I going to act on that thought I've had? Will it be me? Matthew tells the story in such a way that we are there at the table with Jesus, and I think we're meant to ask that question of ourselves. Is it I, Lord? Am I the one that will betray you? Lent is a great time for self-reflection, to consider what is really true of your heart. It's a time to question yourself. Question yourself. Again, this is different than the kind of advice we receive in our culture. We're told by the voices around us to be confident, to be sure of ourselves, to trust our instincts, that we've got the answers, that we just need to go forward and do it. We're supposed to create a brand, cultivate our reputation, and promote our accomplishments. It's all about us. We can do this. But there are times when Jesus invites us to look inside and ask those hard questions. It might seem like we're all together. Here we are. We're churchgoers on a Sunday morning, a beautiful day in Palo Alto. We're doing the right thing. Here we are in church. But it's likely that one of you is being unfaithful to your spouse. One of you is swindling someone else. One of you is abusing someone you love. One of you is leading a double life that you think no one knows about. One of you is so focused on your own success that nobody else in your life matters. One of you has lost your way. One of you would betray Jesus. There are times where Jesus exposes us, calls us out, not to hurt us or to shame us, but to free us from the burden of carrying a lie, of living in darkness. What's really true of you? What questions do you need to be asking during this Lenten series? Jesus makes this announcement and the disciples have this intense period of self-doubt, but then it seems as if they realize it's actually Judas. It's a little ambiguous as to whether everybody realizes it's Judas or only him or only Jesus, but it seems as if perhaps they realize Judas is the bad guy and he probably leaves. And everybody goes, whew, I thought I was going to be found out. But it's him. It's not me. I'm okay. It's the other guy. And everybody feels like they've gotten off. I'm off the hook. That secret I thought might be exposed, it's still safe. Everything's fine. And so things continue. But again, they continue with another surprise. Listen to verses 26 through 30. Now, as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat. This is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. The Passover celebration followed a kind of liturgy. There was this sequence of events that all were supposed to happen in the right time. So the breaking of bread was a normal part of the Passover meal. It was broken matzah, unleavened bread, to remind God's people of the bread they ate when they didn't have time to let it rise because they were escaping from Egypt. There were four cups that were consumed at different points during the meal. The cup that Jesus uses here is probably the one referred to as the cup of blessing. So all of these things were normal. It would be normal for Jesus to break bread. It would be normal for him to distribute a cup. What was strange is that he took these traditional things and he seemed to change the meaning. He messed with tradition. He took the bread and he said, "This is my body." And he takes the cup and he says, "This is my blood." I've mentioned my family likes tradition, and so one of ours, after Thanksgiving, the day after, is to go cut down our own Christmas tree. We go to this place, same place every year, we get the saw, and we walk around for the required 20 or so minutes arguing about the tree, and then finally we kind of agree and we cut it down, and the day moves on. But every now and then, every couple of years, I'll suggest, "Hey, why don't we try a new place?" And there's universal agreement that that is a terrible, heretical, world-destroying idea. That we go to this place, and we've always gone, and we cannot go to another place, or Christmas will not come. See, traditions matter because they're the same every year. Now imagine not just Jesus trying to change a tradition in one family that's happened for a decade, but a tradition that's happened in an entire ethnic group for 1,000 or more years, always the same. And Jesus takes those things and he says, "I'm going to change things up." He changes their meaning. Or maybe it's more accurate to say he adds a new layer of meaning on top of what was already there. He takes these elements that looked back to the freedom from slavery in Egypt, and he says, "There's a new kind of freedom coming. A freedom based on the forgiveness of sins. A freedom based on my death, my broken body, and my shed blood. And this is a freedom that will give you a new kind of relationship with the Father." And so with this new introduction of a new kind of freedom, Jesus is changing our focus. All the disciples had been questioning themselves. They'd been inward looking. But now Jesus says, "Now look at what I'm doing. Look at what I'm doing for you. And instead of worrying about yourself, rely on me. Look at what God has done in your life." And so we're snapped out of questioning ourselves to focus on the work of Jesus. And that's what Lent does. It gives us a time not just to question ourselves, but to remember what Jesus has done. Remember what God has done. A friend of mine in college once asked me, "Why do Christians wear a cross? Why all the morbid fascination with the death of a guy on a symbol of torture and execution? Why do you remember that? Why not something a little cheerier?" And the question is actually a very common one. It was asked a lot in the first couple centuries after Jesus' resurrection. We've recovered an ancient second century document that's called the Octavius of Minucius Felix. Sounds like it should be in Harry Potter, right? But it's not. A real document. And this document records a debate between a Christian and a pagan, an official follower of the Roman religion. Several questions about Christianity are raised. The first of which is, the religion of the Christians is foolish inasmuch as they worship a crucified man. And then it goes on to reference rumors that they're initiated by the slaughter and the blood of an infant. Thirstily, they lick up its blood. Now, of course, this rumor wasn't true. The early church didn't feast on the blood of infants, but you can see how this meal that the Christians did every time they gathered, where they would drink the blood of their Savior, could have gotten misunderstood. And to an outsider, seem gruesome and horrible. Why would you do this? Why would you celebrate such a tragedy? And it is gruesome, but it's celebrated not because it's gruesome, but because it's costly. The death of Jesus was a costly event. And the life that God offers comes at a great cost. So it's not easily obtained. So it's not a simple fix. This was as hard as it could have been. What God has done cost him dearly. He paid our price. He carried our shame. He bore our guilt on himself. A price was paid, and we were bought with that price. The magnitude of that price reveals the magnitude of God's love for us. Because it was so costly, we know that God was willing to go to the greatest lengths possible for our sakes. And by that fact, we know that God loves us dearly. And so we celebrate the cost because it reminds us of what God has done for us and how valuable we are for him to have paid that price. We question ourselves, but then we remember what God has done for us. Now, so far, our story has been a bit emotionally chaotic. The disciples were looking forward to this great meal. They get there. There's this strange certain man. And then Jesus drops this bomb about a betrayer. And then he takes their familiar ceremony and he reinterprets it. And everything's kind of gone crazy. But there's one more surprise left, one more twist that they're faced with. Listen to verses 31 through 35. Then Jesus said to them, after all of this, you will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee. Peter answered him, though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Jesus said to him, truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. Peter said to him, even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. And all the disciples said the same. A moment earlier, Jesus had invited his followers, drink of it, all of you. Now he says, all of you will fall away. Before he'd said, one of you will betray me. Now he says, all of you will fall away. We're not talking about a single bad apple. We're talking about the whole basket going rotten. Every single one of his followers would abandon him that night. I've coached a few of my kids at different points in their lives with different sports. And there's always that time as a coach where you have to give your team a pep talk. You know, maybe it's timeout and they're behind and you want to kind of rally them, or just before the game. And truth is, at least as far as I can tell, there's only four or five things you really say during a pep talk. You know, go for it, have fun, play like you mean it, go get them. You know, just like the stock phrases you say. And reading this passage, I was wondering, what if I gathered my team and I said, you are all going to fail miserably right now. Every single one of you, when it matters the most, will completely fall apart. You'll be humiliated. You'll walk away with your head hung low. This will end badly. Go get them. It's not much of a pep talk, right? But this is what Jesus says to his followers. All of you will fall away. In my hour of greatest need, those closest to me will abandon me. Of course, Peter tries to correct Jesus. Pro tip, that's always a bad idea. Correcting Jesus never works out well. He's convinced that the others might fall away, but not him. And you can hear the desperation in his voice. I think he knows it might be true, and he wants it not to be true, and he's hanging on to some version of himself where he's better than he really is. And so we're left to question ourselves again. Not just that one of us is going to betray Jesus, but that all of us will abandon him. And maybe this is what we need, to know that we're not all that. To know that we shouldn't be let off the hook. That those things that we know to be true inside us need to be known. They need to be revealed. That Jesus invites us to come and stand in the light and face the hardest thing that's true about ourselves. Be realistic. Admit our own weakness. Own our need. If January 1st is the time for New Year's resolutions and commitments to do better, then Lent is a time to realize that we can't keep those resolutions. Most of them have already fallen away, that we're not as strong as we think, that we are limited. You might walk into this room and you might see accomplishment and advanced degrees and wealth and important jobs in influential industries. You might see families that look like they have it all together, and couples that are deeply in love, and people with a sense of fulfillment and purpose in their life. And you might look at the person next to you and think, man, they are killing it, and I am not. Why does everybody else have it together when I don't? But if you had eyes to see, you would walk into this room and you would see lonely people. You would see broken hearts. You would see insecurity and anxiety, hurting marriages, hidden addictions, people who look like they have it together but who are just struggling to keep things going day by day. There's none of us that are immune to the pain and suffering of the world. There's none of us that have it together like we like to think we do. All of us would fall away. And so this invitation then is helpful to us, because it reminds us that when we look inward, when we question ourselves and we own our need, what comes of that is actual freedom. Freedom not to keep looking inward, but to look again on what Jesus has done. Because we realize that we have nothing to offer, that it's not about us, that we can't pull this off, that we're not going to win this game, but that Jesus has done it for us. And so once again, through these ups and downs, we fall back down again on the finished work of Jesus, knowing that that is what we need. That is the only answer to the darkness in our hearts. Jesus invites us there. He invites us to face what's true about us so that we can rely on what he's done. Maybe you don't know Jesus. Maybe you're here checking things out. You have questions. Maybe you used to believe and you're not sure anymore. Maybe you need to have some things exposed. Maybe you need to come into the truth so you can be freed from that burden of carrying it yourself, to have your sins forgiven and to enter into a new life. Maybe you've known Jesus for a while, but maybe you've forgotten, and you're so wrapped up in building up this image of yourself. You've bought into your own story. You've convinced yourself, but you're exhausted by it. You need to step back and say, I'm broken, and my only hope is what Jesus has done. Whatever it is for you, wherever you are now, whatever God has done to bring you here, He's inviting you into a time of looking at him, of resting in his work. This is a place, as Mo said, where you can come as you are. Let down your guard. Stop pretending. Stop trying to be a certain way. Be honest and rest in Jesus. Well, going into a big meal like Thanksgiving, we often have these expectations. It's going to be a certain way. Everything's going to look like this. And it almost never works out that way. It's almost always different. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes people say four words that ruin everything. As Jesus enters into the final hours of his life, all the expectations about what might happen on this night are violated. Everything looks different. But all of it is part of God's plan, working out his purposes in the world. Where are you? What has brought you here? What is God doing next? As we begin this preaching series during the time of Lent, we invite you to enter into this season as one of reflection. One of the ways that we're doing that is that we're suggesting you might join us in doing a reading plan through the Gospel of Matthew, the entire Gospel of Matthew, as we preach from the last part of this book. There's an insert in your bulletin, a bookmark that you can use to follow along. If you go to pbc.org/Lent, there's a link to a Bible reading plan on the Bible app that you can follow. There's also regular readings posted on our Facebook and Instagram accounts if you want to follow that way. But it's an opportunity for us as a community to join together and be reading along the same things and using those stories as a way to guide our reflection on ourselves and on Jesus. Whether or not you follow a reading plan, I'd like to invite you to try to take some time this season to reflect. Maybe it's a few minutes each day. Lent begins on Wednesday, traditionally called Ash Wednesday of this week. Maybe it's over lunches. I'm going to be taking Wednesday lunches to fast and pray. Maybe you'd like to do something similar to that. But try to schedule in some time for these 40 days to stop and reflect and think about what God might be doing in your life. We've been sensing as a church God's call to move us outward, to bless our city, to bless our communities, to offer ourselves in service to our neighbors. But anything we have to offer comes from what we have within, comes from our connection with Jesus. So spend some time, be connected so that you can be a blessing. This morning we've let the words of Jesus and the interactions of his disciples be our guide. The disciples asking, "Is it I?" Jesus saying, "Take and eat." Let these things guide you into a deeper place. Question yourself, but know that even when we are faithless, Jesus is faithful. Amen.